You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows like us at podcast.hyperx.com.
This week on Retronauts, the brave little toaster dog. Everybody, and welcome to Retronauts. I'm your host for this week, Nadia Oxford of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm accompanied by some very good friends of mine. We have Jared Petty, we have Ash Paulson, and of course we have Mr. Jeremy Parrish. I'd like everyone to say hi and introduce themselves, starting with you, Jared.
Yeah, I'm Jared. My day job's at Limited Run Games, where I mix up with Jeremy, and my night job is making the Top 100 Games podcast, which I do for fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun, a lot of painful fun. How about you, Jeremy? Go ahead.
I just do the stuff he just mentioned, pretty much. Also, sometimes
piggybacking off.
Sometimes I'm on Retronauts. I don't know.
On occasion, yeah, we have you slumming around the place.
Someone is hot rotting. I like that.
Yeah, sorry. I live right above like a major street in Los Angeles, and that happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. I apologize.
Well, as we record this, this is actually St. Patrick's Day. So my neighborhood is not just St. Patrick's Day, but also Purim, which is a Jewish holiday where you get completely crunk. Oh. So I get it from all sides today. It's actually
hilarious. Purim was in Secret of Mana, not Secret of Evermore.
Oh,
I thought her name was Purim, but no, apparently it's Purim. So Purim, but I think Purim's a better name.
But it's often romanized as Purim. So I choose to believe,
as it should be,
that she is the first Jewish JRPG hero. Heroine, yes.
Nice.
I will take that, because Secret of Mana was also one of my first RPGs, and we will certainly get to that today. But first, Mr. Ash, you have been talking, but you have not introduced yourself. Please say hi.
So my name is neither Purim nor Purim. It's Ash Paulson. I'm the creator and co-founder of Good Vibes Gaming, which is basically the entire Game Explained crew back together under a new umbrella. And for my day job, I work for Renaissance PR, where I do content creator outreach for various indie games. And I'm super happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Nadia.
Oh, we're very happy to have you. And we just had you on Axe of the Blood God for our Kingdom Hearts ranking. And that was a discussion,
so
all
fun.
Right.
That was so fun. I was buzzing about that. Like, I've been buzzing about that ever since. Like, I got to have a super nerdy Kingdom Hearts in-depth conversation with some good buddies. I was so happy. That was so fun.
How many bodies did you have to climb over for that? Like, that just sounds like a bloody slaughter waiting to happen.
It got pretty contentious at times, for sure. It got a little heated in a good way.
It got a little heated, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a good time, very positive energy, good time had by all. Everyone should go ahead and check that out. But today we're actually here to talk about what I consider one of Squaresoft's most interesting projects outside of Kingdom Hearts, I suppose, and that is Secret of Evermore. Now, this was Square's first Western game. It was an action RPG developed in Redmond, Washington. It had a really interesting, solid development team behind it, but there was a lot going against this game, and I think we're going to talk about that today. First, though, let's start with our histories with the game. Have you guys played it? Do you have it? Did you buy it? Well, Ash, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay, so I did buy it, but I had a weird kind of mindset going into it. So I had just recently discovered Squaresoft at the time, through Final Fantasy VI, aka FF3, and FF6 like completely opened my eyes to a whole new side of gaming that I had never experienced before. And so when I played that, I was like, Squaresoft, I got to pay attention to these guys, but it's probably never going to get better than FF6. And then Chrono Trigger happened and it got better than FF6. And I was like, Squaresoft, oh my God, these guys can do no wrong. And I'm going to buy every single game that comes out from them. And then Secret of Evermore happened. And by that time I had played Secret of Mana. So I was like, right. Oh man, I'm excited for this. This is going to be the next big, amazing, great game from Squaresoft. And then it kind of wasn't. Well, not kind of wasn't. It really wasn't. And I still am glad I played it, just for the history and just for the context of what this game means in the wider context of Square at the time. But it didn't land for me the same way, obviously, that Chrono Trigger and Secret of Mana and FF6 did. So it was very much like a waking up moment for me. Like, okay, Squaresoft is awesome, but yeah, they can misfire sometimes. But at the time either, I didn't know the Square USA history when I first played it. So I knew it felt different, but I didn't know why.
We'll get into all of that, of course. But Jared, how about you?
Yeah, this is one of what I think of as a permanent marker game, which is a game that I got my hands on eventually either through rental or a yard sale or something where they came with permanent marker already written on it, somebody else's name or a price. And that's because I love Secret of Mana. I loved a lot of early Square games. But I was not as plugged into the Square publisher kind of personality cult yet as I would become later on in life. So I played a lot of Square RPGs, a lot of Enix RPGs as well. Loved that stuff. But I also remembered, you know, King's Knight as well. So, you get the other.
Deep cut.
Hell yeah.
I knew there were some ones out there that were a little painful that I could kind of half remember. But Evermore came along after Mana, and I didn't pay as much attention to it. I think because it came out at the end of 95 and at the beginning of 96, Civ 2 came out. And this is when I was really starting to get sucked into PC gaming. And so I missed this one when it was new contemporaneous. It kind of came back to it. And I think I have a warmer relationship with it because I wasn't just frothing at the bit for the Secret of Mana sequel to come out immediately. Mm-hmm. And when I did encounter it, there was enough distance between them that I didn't get punched in the gut as hard as some folks did.
Right. That makes sense. And how about you, Parrish?
Well, as the resident old timer here, I was already pretty well tuned into what video games were all about and the happenings of the business, the internet, all of that. So I was very well aware of this game as it kind of led up. I saw, you know, the Nintendo Power previews. I saw previews in other magazines. I remember, you know, flipping through a magazine at a bookstore and they were gushing about how there were pre-rendered graphics for some of the bosses and installations. And I was like, ooh, neat. That's high tech. Everyone loves that.
That'll never get old.
I had been aware of Square games since Rad Racer came to the US actually. But I got them confused. I got them confused with Rare Coinet. Like they conflated in my brain for a long time. But then, you know, I kind of gradually spun them out separately and, you know, played Final Fantasy when I borrowed it from a friend and played all the way through it, rented Final Fantasy II, bought Final Fantasy III. It was really Secret of Mana that, you know, I got that on a rental and played it for basically an entire Christmas holiday when it first came out, and just thought it was the best. I really liked it. And, so needless to say, I learned they were making another game in kind of the series, I was very interested in it. And I also was aware that, yes, there was a real Secret of Mana 2 coming out in Japan. Mm. And it had like pumpkins and the screenshots of the pumpkins looked really cool.
Right.
But I was interested in playing both. There's this kind of either or mindset that people had, but mm-hmm. I didn't have that. I was like, I would like to play Secret of Evermore and Secret of Mana 2. And so, you know, one of those came to America right away, and one of them came to America many years later. Now I've played both, and I like both, yes. And I'm happy about that.
Decades later.
But yeah, there was, I don't know, there was like a sense of resentment about this game for a long time. As if it was like a replacement for Secret of Mana 2. We can talk about that later, but... You know, by the same token, I had also played Breath of Fire, which Square published in the US, even though it was a Capcom game. So I don't know, like I just kind of saw it as all pretty fluid and flexible. So I bought Secret of Evermore when it came out and said, hot dang, this is good. And maybe I didn't like it as much as Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy III, aka VI, but... it was still good. I still enjoyed it. And it was different. Like, it had way more text and dialogue and mm-hmm. was more focused around single play. And it had some interesting systems and mechanics. And, you know, the jokes didn't always land, but I appreciated that they tried, which was something you didn't really see happening in video games that often. So, I was into it. I don't know. Between this and Earthbound, it kind of felt like there was this collective thing happening in role-playing games on Super NES at that time, this sort of like, you know, re-digesting Americana sort of thing. And so it just all kind of fit into, like, it all seemed of a piece. And that happens sometimes. Like, you know, in I tackled this, kind of talked about this in some of my NES Works videos for 1988, but... Mm-hmm. there was this like brief period where a bunch of games that had sort of similar themes and names and conventions came out. You had Rambo, you had Iron Tank, and you had Metal Gear, which all had kind of this like sort of military Rambo storyline broadcasting by, or like, you know, communicating by transmitter sort of thing going on. Both Metal Gear and Iron Tank had a hero named Snake. And like, to me, it all just kind of blended together and was like, yeah, this is just what video games do. They all have this thing happening. So I don't know. So like with that mindset, I guess, or that just that sense of, you know, like video games are trend driven and sometimes they do stuff that's all kind of a piece. To me, Secret of Evermore just fit right in. And I still think fondly of it, although I haven't really played it since it came out. So, you know, maybe I'd look back at it and be like, wow, they blew it. But I don't think so. I think, you know, I'd actually be more forgiving of it now, kind of understanding the behind the scenes and, you know, understanding some of the systems even better than I did at the time. So I don't know. I'm fond of this one. I just want to, you know, reach out and tousle its hair. That's a good kid.
I agree.
Yeah.
He's a good kid. That's a very good kid. I like the utopia that exists in your head, by the way, about how all video games were a nice sort of melting pool of trends, and everyone just kind of got along and was inspired by each other, and console wars just never happened. I mean, I'm not saying you're saying that, but it just feels
That's not quite what I mean. I guess I just meant that, like, there's always something in the water with video games.
Absolutely. Sure. I see what you mean now. Yeah. As for myself, like, I have made Earthbound comparisons here, and we will get into them because my story is almost like a mix of all of yours. I was very much looking forward to Evermore when it was announced. By this point, I had been into Final Fantasy 3/6 and Secret of Mana, both of which had huge impacts on me. So, of course, I was like, holy crap, Secret of Evermore, this has got to happen right now. And Parrish, like you mentioned, like, there were a lot of really enticing-looking previews for that game, and, like, game players and Nintendo Power and everything like that. And it just seemed to look really good. And back then, video game release dates were extremely loosey-goosey, more so than they are now, if you can believe it. And I remember hearing that Secret of Evermore was going to come out in the summer, and something called Chrono Trigger was coming out after that. But then it turned out it was reversed. Chrono Trigger came first, and I played that first. And I did not have a big budget. I was saving up for the N64 by that point. So it was a matter of, I got Chrono Trigger. Of course, it blew me away. By the time Secret of Evermore came around, I was a little less than impressed. And I read the reviews, and the reviews were like, this is pretty good. It's not like going to blow you away, but it's pretty good. And, you know, those are generally correct reviews. But this was an age where I had just played Final Fantasy VI. I had just played Chrono Trigger, and I hate to say it, but I kind of stuck my nose up at it for the same reason I stuck my nose up at Earthbound. It was just like, I don't want this kiddie stuff. I want to go back to the apocalypse and jump off a cliff because my boyfriend might be dead. That's
Were you one of those kids that hated Wind Waker back in the day? Oh, no. Oh no.
Man.
No, I was actually always a Wind Waker defender, even when, like, the graphics were kind of in that really early prototype
stage. Same. Nice. Like,
this is pretty good. This actually works out a lot. When I saw the game in motion, like, in the later trailers, I said, how can you not love this? This is incredible. But by that point, I had settled down a bit. I was no longer in my teenage years. By the time Evermore came out, I was just in the throes of angry late teenage puberty. So, of course, I was like, ew, I don't want to play as a boy and his dog. That's stupid.
You're such an edgelord.
The great irony also being that Earthbound, when you dig underneath the surface, it's arguably the darkest of all the games.
Oh, it is absolutely.
It's like,
I have written essays about, not to get on a tangent, but I have written essays about Earthbound if you want to look them up. Primarily about how is the failure of adults to protect children. And it's a game where Ness starts off getting the shit beaten out of him by cops. And looking at that now, and it's like, did they always mean for that to be disturbing, or would they think it was funny? I don't know to this day. Yeah, the reason we kind of bring up Earthbound here is because, as Parrish brought up, whereas Earthbound formed a cult, a huge cult following after the fact, Secret of Evermore, while it certainly has its fans, they're not nearly as driven as, like, say, the Starman crew. They're very much in the vein of, like, perhaps Parrish and I were like, oh, it's a pretty good game. Speaking personally, I can say that I did try playing it later, and I was like, okay, well, I'm not too impressed with these graphics. I was still a bit of a snob. But my husband, for Christmas, got me a repro cart for Secret of Evermore. So I said, okay, I'm going to sit down, play this on the SNES as God intended, and I did. And I'm like, wow, this has some really great ideas, but gosh, it is unbalanced as heck. And I did not find it a lot of fun to play. And something I will get into a little bit later is that this is a game that has several patches to even out the difficulty, and neither of them are as good as they need to be. So something really went wrong with tuning the difficulty there. And I think that was one strike against it versus many strikes, actually. So we'll get into that. But just to recap a little bit about the game itself, again, Western Developer RPG by Squaresoft, released on the SNES in October of 1995. So that's another strike against it. Of course, a lot of games by 1995 are just being overlooked. It's executive producer, and this is really interesting, the late, great Douglas E. Smith, creator of Lode Runner. He was specifically hired by Square Enix to make an RPG with an American motif. Jeremy, you've done a lot of fantastic work about Douglas E. Smith. Like, he wrote a really great retrospective on him back at US Gamer.
Oh, did I? I've written a lot about Lode Runner, but wow. I don't remember really. I don't feel like I know that much about Smith himself. You know, I've forgotten more about Douglas E. Smith than you've ever known. yeah, I mean, like, okay, so Smith was one of the first people who worked for Bruderbund,
yes,
which was an American publisher. It's now part of the Learning Company, I believe. It was bounced around to different owners, but they were kind of a collective publisher that would really like to elevate its talent, you know, kind of like EA in the early days, where they would work with amateur developers, help them polish up their games and get them into the market. I mean, they also worked with a guy named Will Wright, who published a game called Raid on Bungling Bay with them.
That
is the genesis, the inception point of the entire Sims franchise. So yeah, they were an incubator for great talent. I think they might be more familiar to a lot of people of a certain age for publishing The Print Shop, which was not a video game. But
I didn't know they published The Print Shop.
They published The Print Shop. One of the default images, I think, was you could print out the Bruderbund logo with the crowns.
It
would take
beautiful.
Up like, nice. You know, six or seven sheets of that tractor feed banner paper. But anyway,
that's the sound it would make.
So they worked with Smith to publish Lode Runner, and it was a big hit on PCs in America. And then Bruderbund, maybe they saw that things were happening in Japan, or Japanese publishers were like, hey, you publish cool stuff, you should license your games to us. But in any case, they licensed their games out to Hudson and to Sega and a few other publishers, and Lode Runner became a huge phenomenon in Japan. I know Douglas E. Smith said in an interview with IGN in like 1998, that's how long ago this was, that, you know, Lode Runner was popular here, but what people don't know is that the majority of its sales happened in Japan. And I will say Kate Willert, the game historian, a few months ago put together a charting like the first 6 month sales of Lode Runner across all platforms. And it was like, you know, 100,000 copies on Apple II, which was a massive hit back in 1983.
Yeah.
But then she showed the comparison for the SG-1000 version, which was also about on par with the Apple II version, which is crazy because, you know, there were only a fraction of SG-1000 units sold compared to the Apple II, which was a massive, like, just widespread system on multiple continents. But then she showed the Famicom sales, which was published by that version was published by Hudson, and it was like 10 times as many. It was just unbelievable numbers. And so Smith really, he played an important part in the legacy of Nintendo, because Nintendo at the Famicom, which became the NES in America, didn't really become a big deal in Japan until the third parties arrived, beginning with Hudson. And when Hudson published Nuts and Milk and Lode Runner, like, that was when the Famicom really just began to go out of control in terms of sales, and sales right. skyrocketed. And it wasn't because of Hudson, but there was this correlation there where all of a sudden people were buying Famicom systems, and everything up to that point had been like, hey, here's Donkey Kong. Here's a port of, Donkey Kong 3 and Mario Brothers, and here's Mahjong. And those were, successful. But all of a sudden people, were buying the system by the millions, and they were like, we want more games. And here was Hudson saying, here are games for you. And they made, Lode Runner. They took Lode Runner with its little stick men and single color bricks, and they made it cute. In fact,
very cute.
The enemy robots, they ceased to be, like stick figure robots, and they became Bombermen. They reused that sprite
yes.
as their mascot character for decades to come. That it's just like this weird confluence of video game history. Around the same time, IRIM also produced an arcade version of Lode Runner. That shipped, I think, also in 1984. And once Lode Runner lapsed for Hudson, the license, IRIM started publishing it on Famicom Disk System and put together like super challenging versions of the games.
Right.
So it just sustained its popularity there for years. And, Hudson, eventually it kind of faded away, but Hudson would go back to the well along with other companies. I want to say Bandai published a Game Boy version of it. But then Hudson went back to the well and created Cubic Lode Runner. So I'm not really talking about that much about Doug Smith here, but you do have to understand, like, this is all context to help kind of, I think, explain why he was a great choice for Square USA to tap, to basically be the guy who would take this, basically the engine for this game that was fairly popular in Japan, not so much here, and help guide it, help be a key creative figure in terms of this Japanese publisher launching its actual American studio. And like I said, there's just a lot of history here. And I actually did not realize that Doug Smith worked on Secret of Evermore, but just knowing that is really cool and shows like there was this connection there for sure.
Yes.
All the kind of Westerners who were really early making inroads into Japan, such as Hank Rogers with the Black Onyx and later Tetris, or Robert Woodhead, who created Wizardry, which was just right. a huge, huge cult and then mainstream success over there. Like all those guys just, they kept those connections because that's how Japanese business works. Like once you right. make a connection and you there's trust established and a good working relationship, that's just like that, word is bond basically. Like that is a thing that is secure and stable forever. And so, yeah, like there's, there is some real legacy heritage type history going on with Secret of Evermore because of Smith's involvement. That's which I think is really cool.
It is.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Dunn, host of the O3C podcast. Every week I'm joined by my two best gaming buddies, Chris and Minty, and we talk about the games we're playing, the games we love, and how they rank alongside our sacrosanct top 100 favourite video games of all time lists. Deep dives into gaming mechanics, history and lore abound, all topped off with lashings of irreverent wry British wit, witterings and wisdom. For details on the show and more, head to o3c.games and tune in every Monday on the HyperX Podcast Network.
New this April from HyperX, it's the HyperX Clutch Controller. Get better control of your mobile gaming with its comfortable grip, directional pad, analog sticks, and shoulder buttons. This versatile controller can fit a variety of phone widths, and can also connect wirelessly for use on tablets and PCs. Learn more and pick one up online at HyperX and HP.com, Amazon, Micro Center, Target, Best Buy, and many other fine retailers.
For every episode of No More Whoppers that you listen to, we will send you a 25-cent coupon for participating Kroger's. How many Kroger's are participating? None, but you're still getting the coupon.
And it's like 25 cents in 1985 dollars.
Right, so today that's like...
28 cents.
No More Whoppers. Take that to the bank and smoke it.
On the HyperX Podcast Network and nomorewhoppers.com.
New this April from HyperX. It's the HyperX Clutch Controller. Get better control of your mobile gaming with its comfortable grip, directional pad, analog sticks, and shoulder buttons. This versatile controller can fit a variety of phone widths and can also connect wirelessly for use on tablets and PCs. Learn more and pick one up online at HyperXandHP.com, Amazon, Micro Center, Target, Best Buy, and other fine retailers.
I've talked about a lot of things that aren't Secret of Evermore for like 10 minutes, so I'll turn the table back over to you.
No, as you say, it's a really important bit of context. Even just kind of continuing the thread of conversation very briefly, I think that the Your NES Works series has taught me just how much the start of the Famicom and the start of the NES were so different. For years and years, I thought, oh, they were kind of the same thing. I'm sure it was the same progression, but no. Whereas, as you said, the Famicom had games like Lode Runner to really boost it the way that Super Mario Brothers did for us. Like, it's just a really, really interesting difference. And I'm always interested to hear how, like, what role the West plays in that. And as you said, I would imagine since Doug Smith had that respect behind him for doing that for Lode Runner, it's no wonder that Square Enix said, hey, how about making us a game? That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it? And Bob's your uncle, as they say. Unfortunately, it didn't get the recognition I can't really say it deserves or not. That's what I'm trying to figure out here. And we've already talked a little bit about our histories with the game. And what I want to know is, would you regard it as an overlooked gem or just kind of a game that its obscurity is not surprising? And this is something this is an argument I've kind of written out more thoroughly. But if you have any generalized opinions on where Secret of Evermore lies in our collective consciousness and whether that's fair or not, go ahead and sound off. I'm receptive to that.
This is a game, I think, that suffers from comparison again and again and again. We've made comparisons to Earthbound because it has a semi-nostalgic setting. It's funny in ways. It takes place or begins at a town called Podunk. That's cute.
Yes.
Well, that's adorable. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like it would belong in Earthbound. Unfortunately, what it doesn't have is that weird, esoteric, ethereal.
Right.
Yeah.
Sadness of Earthbound. And without it, it's not quite as meaningful emotionally. When you look at the mechanics of the game, it does a lot of the things that Secret of Mana did right. I think the charge meter actually works pretty well, even though it's unbalanced in places, but that's a good way to keep you from just spamming in combat. I mean, you're effectively Marty McFly with a bone, you know, that you're beating things
with. You look
like
right. it too.
And
right.
You have the vest and everything.
Yeah. I'm exactly. sure everyone in Evermore is like, are you afraid you're going to drown? What's going on? Did you escape from the Navy?
Yeah, exactly. He's got his life preserver on, but he's walking around with a bone, but it doesn't quite have the zip that Mana did,
right.
that Seiken Densetsu 2 does. And it kind of suffers in a divergent way, I think just kind of on its own from what would become late Mana-itis, where everything slows down and your guys have more trouble moving around. At the same time, it misses the beautiful, wonderful point of the two-player cooperative where you get together. The beauty of Secret of Mana is sitting down with your nerdiest of nerdy friends in the early 90s.
Yes. Yeah.
And being able to play an RPG with another human being, an action RPG. And they give you the dog and they're like, here's this thing you could have had.
Right.
You could have had this wonderful two, but we're not going to give you that. And it's again and again, these comparisons. That's how we criticize. We criticize by context, so it makes sense. Yet I can't think of a game where we so often like, well, compared to Chrono Trigger, well, compared to Final Fantasy VI, well, compared to Earthbound, well, compared to Secret of Mana, well, and that's the problem. When you, it's a pretty good game.
Yeah.
It's just not as good as all the other good games there were to play at the same time.
Exactly.
And that hurts it.
Yeah. I think that's kind of where I'm landing on it is like, I wouldn't call it an overlooked gem. I think Jim is probably putting it a little bit strongly.
Might be a little bit generous.
Probably a little bit generous, but I think it's a pretty good game. And I think it's worth playing, especially for, you know, anyone interested in the history of gaming and especially RPGs and Squaresoft's history. And it's definitely worth checking out. And there's a lot to like about this game. But I do think it, as you were saying, it does suffer from those comparisons. And I think specifically where Secret of Mana is concerned, I think it really suffers from the comparison with Mana's aesthetics. You know,
right.
Secret of Mana is one of the most colorful games on the Super Nintendo, and it has one of the most melodically driven soundtracks
Absolutely.
On the Super Nintendo. Whereas Evermore, it's not necessarily worse, but it's very drab and very bleak
Yes.
in comparison. A lot, many darker colors, and not nearly as colorful. And the soundtrack by Jeremy Sewell is very ambient and very, almost kind of sounds very bleak too, and a little sad, and it's very muted.
Absolutely.
Completely the opposite of Secret of Mana. And so I think when you see Secret of in that title,
Yes.
if you played Mana, you can't help but kind of expect that, right? And so I think that definitely is where kind of some of that, that comparison really made Evermore suffer. And I was really thinking about this while I was looking through your notes, Nadia, and I was really having a trouble trying to figure out why that kind of Americana vibe worked for Earthbound and is well loved in Earthbound, but maybe not necessarily as much in Evermore. And I think where it finally, my light bulb moment, and this is great. What you wrote down here is you called it, Americana boomer wank.
Yeah.
You said the story for Secret of Evermore immediately felt like Americana boomer wank. Don't apologize because that I think is a great point. They both have an Americana vibe, but whereas Secret of Evermore, whereas Earthbound feels like it is being played and written from the perspective of a child going out
Right.
into the world with all the wonder and fear that implies, Secret of Evermore feels like it's a boomer writing about his glory
Yes.
days as a kid and what he remembers Americana culture was like when he was a kid. And there are a lot of tongue-in-cheek references, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I was around 11 when I played Secret of Evermore,
exactly.
I think. So I didn't really care about an adult perspective. I like that perspective from the eyes of a kid that you get in Earthbound. It's easy to insert yourself into Ness's role compared to someone like Podunk Boy, which I just didn't really, you know, I didn't watch a lot of B movies as a kid. I didn't really
have that
kind of frame of reference. So it was really hard for me to identify, I guess, with the Americana vibe in Evermore versus Earthbound. And your Americana boomer wank line absolutely is what was the light bulb moment for me there.
Yeah,
I think just to build off. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jeremy. You didn't get to say anything.
Yeah, I was going to say Earthbound is written from an outsider perspective. It's not written
Yes.
from people who lived through, you know, the American culture that they're kind of digesting through, you know, secondhand, third hand, whereas Evermore is written from the perspective of people who lived there and, you know, were surrounded by this all their lives. And it feels very contemporary to the kind of cartoons that were on TV. Like if you look at Animaniacs, Tiny Toon Adventures, Warner Brothers cartoons from that era, the early 90s, or even something like Batman, the animated series, or Superman, like they are full of kind of, you know, a lot of it's self-referentialism.
Mm-hmm. That's
true. But, you know, like they're full of jokes about things that adults at the time would have understood, you know, not so much the kids who were theoretically the core audience. You know, I mean, Tiny Toons and Animaniacs did that all the time, making references to like Dean Martin and stuff like that, like, or Jerry Lewis, like, you know, kids.
Yeah.
Kids in the 90s didn't know who Jerry Lewis was. They don't understand Hello Nurse. It was for their moms and dads. Or even like, you know, the Grey Ghost episode of Batman, the animated series.
Oh, that was great.
Which is, brilliant, just such a great piece of animation. But at the same time, like the fact that they stunt casted Adam West as the Grey Ghost, you know, that's not for the kids. That is for the parents. And I feel like this was written from that same perspective. The writing in here is very much in that kind of vein. And I do think that really dates it. And it does make it alienating for people who don't have that proper context. But I understand why it happened that way, because I think that was just how it was sort of understood that you wrote about kind of the American past at that point. I mean, even Star Trek did that. Deep Space Nine with, you know, like a pioneering special effects episode. Forrest Gump, you know, going back into the Tribbles episode of Star Trek and inserting modern actors into it. But, you know, Forrest Gump taking archival footage and using CG to make it look like Forrest was talking to Nixon or whatever. Like, that was just the thing at the time. You know, America patting itself on its back right before the country just went down the tubes. You know, there was like this last minute of like, we did it, everyone. We beat communism. Everything's perfect. The future is great. Nothing's ever going to be bad again. but let's look at back where it started, this greatness that we have. So I get it. But I do think that dates it.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I do want to go to bat for this game because yes, it has flaws, but at the same time, like when people compare it to other Super NES RPGs, what are you comparing it to? You're comparing it to this cherry-picked selection of Final Fantasy games and its offshoots, Mana and Chrono Trigger. You're comparing it to Earthbound. You're comparing it to what else? Oh, nothing else, really. Maybe ActRaiser, because, you know, that was kind of the same. Or Soul Blazer, because those were like the same sort of action RPG context.
Right.
But if you look at everything else that landed in the Super NES RPG bucket, it's mostly crap. No one's like, you know, Secret of Evermore was okay, but I really wish I was playing Tecmo's Secret of the Stars. I wish I was playing
I was going to find a place to make a Tecmo's Secret of the Stars reference here.
Nice.
Sorry. I stole it from you. But yeah, like,
that's okay.
Most Super NES RPGs were actually crap. And those are just the ones that came to America. When you look at the games that did not come to America, the vast majority of those were flaming garbage, flaming hot garbage.
No, I agree. Cheetah. I agree with that. But
like you are comparing Secret of Evermore to like the creme de la creme. Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't deserve to stand on Parnassus and look down at the mortals and sneer. But maybe it deserves to like live on the slopes of Parnassus and not be, you know, be kind of pushed down with the garbage, you know, the horrible scum living in the realms of Hades.
No, absolutely not.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
So it is all about context.
It is absolutely all about context, especially since Secret of Evermore, even though it made some mistakes, say, with its titling, I think that's a big one, it's not a game that thinks, like, it's not full of itself. It's a very, very lighthearted game. I actually was going to get into the soundtrack and how it kind of mismatches the theme of the game, even though it's
weird,
a really excellent soundtrack. But it is very strange. But I think maybe one of my bigger problems at the time was that you had this nameless hero kid who, by the way, his character art looks like Fred Flintstone. It's driving me crazy. I'm just expecting to light up a Winston cigarette. But he doesn't have anything to him except mentioning, this looks like such and such from such and such. Like, what was it? Mars Needs Lumberjacks is one of the movies he references. All he does is talk in movie references. It's actually Family Guy before Family Guy. It's actually hell.
Yeah, but I was going to say, Secret of Evermore is actually a very, very ahead of its time kind of creation. Not only because of all the, like, I view everything in terms of pop culture. I have no original thoughts of my own, just like Family Guy. You also have, you know, the ambient soundtrack that you guys were criticizing before. I mean, I think it's a really good and interesting soundtrack. There was
I'm not criticizing the soundtrack.
There was nothing else like it on Super NES. Like, you know, maybe the early hours of, or the early moments of Super Metroid, where it's spooky and stuff, and you've just got sort of ambient sound instead of melodies, but you just didn't hear that kind of ambient approach to music on Super NES. That was really pretty far ahead of its time. And also the crafting system, like, it's definitely flawed, but the using reagents and everything to create alchemy, like, who did that back then? That was pretty interesting. Like, Dragon Quest, Skyrim, I don't know, like, those would come along decades later and do that sort of thing, but at the time, like,
I mean, that's an Ultima 4 innovation, I think. That is true,
but yeah, but who is playing Ultima 4 and thinking, ah, yes, I'm going to make an action RPG? I don't know. Like, still, just like combining all these things was, I feel like the game was kind of, you know, it just happened a little too early in some senses, but also a little too late. It's weird.
It was definitely a victim of bad timing. I will say that much. And if we want to just jump ahead directly to the soundtrack, because I was going to talk a little bit about that, because I don't want to say it was a downside of the game. It certainly wasn't. The problem was then we were so used to bombastic soundtracks. Like, God, there was an opera. God, Dancing Mad is 20 minutes on a cartridge. Chrono Trigger, God, the Undersea Palace theme is still one of my most favorite pieces of music ever composed on a video game. And this is soundtrack by, is it Jeremy Soule or Soleil or...
I've always said Soul, but I don't know if that's actually correct.
It's the guy we don't talk about now.
He who shall not be kind of named, but because he was accused of rape in 2019. I will say that I don't think he's working with Bethesda anymore. I can't say for sure, but I can say this was his first, as far as I know, composition. And from what I have dug up, apparently he was with Square because he was a bug tester on, I think, Final Fantasy VI. So at some point they realized, hey, you're really good at music. But yes, this is a very, very... See, if you don't know, and I'm sure you all know, but just in case our lovely audience doesn't know, Soule eventually composed, Elder Scrolls.
Yeah.
Like,
Dragonborn. That's kind of what I was getting at with the Skyrim comparisons, too. But also, at the same time, not celebrating a bad person. So
yeah.
It's challenging. Right. It's tricky. Why do people have...
It always is.
Don't even get me started on Dragon Quest. God damn it.
Oh,
what is it with musicians and being judged?
Right.
And Castlevania, no.
Yeah. Parrish, I think you said it perfectly earlier when you mentioned that there's really no other soundtrack like it.
Exactly.
On Super Nintendo, except for maybe some of, as you said, Super Metroid's early tracks. But I think, like, as Nadia was saying, I think this is a fantastic soundtrack, and I often go back to it. I'm obsessed with video game music. But I think the issue was, what you said, Nadia, was that it kind of betrayed our expectations coming off of FF6 and Chrono Trigger, which is fine in hindsight, but at the time it was like, wait, this isn't what I was expecting. But also that it was just so mismatched to the game it was in. Great soundtrack.
Yeah.
But it's such a lighthearted game, and the music is genuinely not just ambient, but it just has this bleakness to it, this muted bleakness to it. And it's just, it doesn't, some of the game, I guess, has that vibe to it. Some of the later areas you go to in terms of the time periods. And there's definitely a pervasive sense of dreariness to some of the game, but I would argue that the majority of the game is much lighter hearted than the soundtrack would imply.
Yeah.
It does play to a kind of a tonal dissonance. I agree. I think this game, the soundtrack you're hearing sounds like something that would be pumped out of like a PC ad lib speaker in about 1996. It's very much more in that world of like PC composition, and that kind of weird, I mean, it's running through the Super Nintendo sound chip, but it almost has that weird FM synthesis vibe to it.
Yeah.
That and the muted color palette. It feels like somebody played Secret of Mana in 1993 and then made a Genesis game.
That's a good way to put it.
In 1995.
That's an interesting comparison.
Yeah. That's how this game feels. And it, to me, I mean, I can't qualify that, so maybe that's just bullshit, but it has a kind of a weird Genesis-y American team vibe. Like, we saw some ideas here. Let's make that. And I wonder if this wouldn't be better accepted Jeremy said several times this episode on the NES, on the SNES. I think he's nailed it. I wonder if we would accept this better if it had just come across the aisle. Because in that library, it would hold a very different place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the music would not, the soundtrack just wouldn't have happened. The Genesis sound chip just didn't have,
yeah,
the capabilities,
been like, bow, bow, bow.
Of, I mean, well, I'm going to give Square the benefit of a doubt and assume they're not going to, they weren't going to use the Gems driver, so their music would have sounded good.
I was wondering about that.
But even so, like, yeah, FM Synthesis just, like, it's a totally different technology than the sampling that the Super NES used. Yeah. And the sampling and kind of that soft, muted, analog kind of quality to the sound is really critical to Evermore's soundscape. So, yeah, I don't think you could have done it. I mean, it would have had a cool soundtrack, I think, on Genesis. Like, I love that sort of cold, artificial, spacey sound, but it's the opposite of, like, you know, kind of warm, ethereal Super NES sound that Evermore created.
Exactly. Yeah, and unfortunately, I guess maybe that was one thing against it, but it wasn't its fault whatsoever. One thing I will get into is I think the game really hurt itself by naming itself Secret of Evermore, because just using the music alone as an example, yes, it was a brilliant soundtrack, but it was so different from Secret of Mana, which is a soundtrack I still hold near and dear to my heart, when you play a game that you think is the sequel to Secret of Mana, because you have no information that says otherwise, so you want to associate the two in your head and assume one is a sequel to the other, but they're so different that to this day, I look at Secret of Evermore and say, maybe that shouldn't have been named Secret of Evermore. It really maybe, it did have a different name at one point. Unfortunately, I'm blanking on it at the moment, but it was something really weird, and I understand why they went with something else. But
a boy and his dog.
Yeah. It may as well have been.
Just take the word Secret of off and you've got a good title for an SNES game. And I love that stupid cover, like big giant red thing. I don't know what that is, but I love it and I want to meet it. And yeah. There's a lot going for it. But you talk about that, you know, I remember where I grew up, you know, regional advertising was very different then. I remember Secret of Mana being advertised on TV. I remember Final Fantasy Adventure being advertised on TV. I don't remember even knowing there was a sequel to Secret of Mana until I saw Evermore ex post facto. And by then I was just like, what? But if you were waiting for a sequel, I can't imagine how disappointed this game would be for you.
It just wouldn't
feel right.
Especially when you factor in, you know, the knowledge that we would later come to have that, you know, there was a real sequel that Japan would get, Seiken Densetsu 3, and the narrative around that, through no fault of Secret of Evermore's own, the narrative around that became, oh, this is another Final Fantasy Mystic Quest situation where Square thinks we're too stupid to play the real sequel to Secret of Mana. You know, this is what we're getting instead. We're getting the scraps because we're dumb Americans, when that wasn't the case ever at all. It was never that.
No, it was never going to be localized. Seiken Densetsu 3 was a huge, huge, huge game. And something I learned much later is that when you localize text from Japanese to English, it takes up a lot more room.
Yep.
So it just wasn't going to happen, especially that late in the SNES's life. But this was a time when us desperate nerds were getting online because we were desperate for friends and people to talk to about video games.
Yep.
But information from overseas and even just the games industry in general was still coming to us very slowly through magazines. So we would kind of parse out our own narratives, for better or for worse, saying how, as you said, Ash, here comes another situation where we're supposed to get, we should get Seiken Densetsu 3, but we're not. We're getting this, you know, this dumb game for Americans. They're doing another Mystic Quest to us because, of course, we were very bitter about Final Fantasy V and missing out on that.
Yeah.
Not really in favor of Mystic Quest. Again, Final Fantasy V is a little more complicated than that, but either way, we knew Final Fantasy V existed. We knew we didn't have it. We knew that we got a substitute Mystic Quest that was really, really dumbed down, and it was kind of insulting to people who loved Final Fantasy IV. So, of course, we had this bitterness towards Evermore through no fault of its own, and I think that was a huge black mark against it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're right, and at least I can say for myself, when you take that extra step that some of us did and, like, you know, import video game music, I went out of my way to import the soundtrack for Seiken Densetsu 3 because, as I understood it, that was the true sequel to Secret of Mana, and it only further inflamed my kind of ingrained bias against Evermore, I guess, as a kid, because I heard that soundtrack and I was like, oh, this is what I was waiting for from the sequel to Secret of Mana musically. This actually is it. Even though, in hindsight, and I still appreciated Evermore soundtrack at the time, and certainly I do in hindsight. But when I took that extra step and listened to the soundtrack from the real sequel to Secret of Mana, I was like, God, but we didn't get this, and this is what I was waiting for. And so that kind of just further inflamed that bias, I guess.
But this game does have a lot going for it. It's got a dog with laser eyes. It's got time travel. It's got cute little set pieces. It's got perfectly decent combat through most of it. It's atmospheric. It's got good music. You know, it's a neat little game. And probably one that deserves to be revisited, because I think a lot of folks probably quit halfway through. And, we like to use Hidden Gem probably because we all grew up writing articles for the same outlets.
But we sure did.
I don't know if it's a hidden gem, but it's at least a penny on the sidewalk. It's worth picking up.
There you go.
Definitely.
See a penny, pick it up, and I'll tell you high good luck. Why not?
Yeah, I definitely have seen a lot of the resentment directed at Evermore for stealing Secret of Mana 2's spot in the Super NES library. But yeah, like, you have to realize that game came on such a huge ROM that it cost, what, like 9,800 yen in Japan? 11,000 yen? I can't remember exactly what it was. It was one of the really expensive games, because it was on such a huge ROM that it cost a lot. And I don't think there were any games published by a third party that were that big in the US. Like, the biggest game I want to say that was published in the US was Kirby's Dream Land 3. But otherwise, the really big honkin' games like that and Star Ocean, Tales of Phantasia, localization issues aside, they were just out because the market wouldn't bear it. They would have been so expensive that, you know, like you saw the complaints about Phantasy Star 4 costing $100. Like, if a Super NES game ended up being $100, there would have been rioting. There would have been, you know, pitchforks and burning buildings and things like that. It would have been bad
by the nerds, the RPG
I think, like, I could be, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like I pretty clearly remember Super Mario RPG retailing for $69.99,
which was unheard of.
Like, it was already
for a Nintendo published game, because they gave themselves the luxury of a tax break, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
I just looked it up here, and the suggested retail price for Seiken Densetsu 3 on the box is 11,400 yen. So that's about 115 bucks gone on it, roughly.
Mm-hmm. And that would be American, wouldn't it? Because I paid over $100 easily for Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy. I've told the story a million times. It's one of my favorites, where I was shopping with my parents and I was going to buy Final Fantasy 3 that day /6. And I had to do something else. And my father went to pick up the game for me at Canadian Tire, of all places, a hardware store, which sold games back in the day because everyone did. And I gave him the $115 that includes tax to pay for the game. And the woman's boxing up the game and she's like, this must be for someone very special. And my dad says, nah. So that's always one of my favorite stories. But it's Seiken Densetsu 3, if it ever came here, we already know we just talked about what the price would have been. It would have been just astronomical. And we mentioned some of the games at the end of the SNES's life that did not have a hope of coming out here. Tales of Phantasia, Star Ocean, forget it. It was just never going to happen. So here's Secret of Evermore. And to our angry little minds, the story was that we're Americans getting the leftovers once again. So we were very resentful little weasels, weren't we?
We sure were. Yep.
Go ahead.
I guess, and this is probably the segue you were probably already going to make, but I think something that maybe further didn't help Evermore was that while it did improve on Secret of Mana's gameplay in some key ways, it also felt like a step back in other ways. It didn't feel like a wholesale improvement the way some sequels, like when you think of like Mega Man 2 compared to Mega Man 1, it didn't feel like a sequel that fully learned from its predecessor's mistakes, right?
No, absolutely. We will get into gameplay for sure in just a second. I do want to say, though, one thing I find very clever about Secret of Evermore is that, just as a dog breed nerd, You are in set. You are going in a world that is set in different quote unquote eras. So you have the prehistoric era, you have the antiquity, you have a gothic era, and you have future era Omnitopia. So for prehistoric, you have a wolf. That's what your dog is. That makes sense. For antiquity, you have a sighthound, a pharaoh hound, I think, or a greyhound, which is exactly the kind of dog breed they would have used back then. Same thing with the gothic and the poodle. And I guess in the future we'll have toaster dogs. So
which was so cool.
Nice work there.
Yeah.
Nice work there.
I always assumed that dog was supposed to be evocative of like K-9, like from Doctor Who or something.
Oh, but I never thought of it that way.
Oh, I never thought about that. Yeah. You know, I feel like the biggest knock against Secret of Evermore, actually, like thinking in terms of the fact that there's a dog in this game and he's your companion, and that's awesome. But I don't think there's ever any instance in which you can actually pet your dog in Secret of Evermore.
Good point.
Which, if there isn't, that's objectively the biggest knock against it. You can't have a dog in an entire game and not be able to pet it. Come on.
I agree. That's a sin.
I honestly think we'd forgive most of Evermore's problems if you could play as the dog, or if you're a second player.
Player two. Yeah, that would be so cool. Yeah.
So you can't play as a second player in Evermore, right? Just to recap.
Right. Not without a patch.
It's not like mana. Well, okay, there would be a patch,
I don't know how
That's the great miss of the point.
I don't know how fun it would be to play as the dog, because the dog is more of a utility character. Yeah, it'll attack things for you, but the dog spends a lot of time sniffing for alchemic reagents.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, like, asymmetric gameplay can be fun, but I don't know if that's necessarily asymmetric gameplay that everyone's craving. Like, I'm just going to sniff around for bits of thread or whatever while you're beating things up. You go over there.
Oh, I shall elaborate.
You go over there and hit your mosquitoes with a femur, and I'm just going to smell the dirt.
In my like mind's time dude. Machine, inventing a sequel to Sickened and Setsu 2, you'd be building a game around two-player gameplay from the bottom up, and the dog would have more to do. I think that's more where it's a talk about missing the point on the part of the developers thing. If you're going to frame this as a sequel to one of the best multiplayer games of its time.
But honestly,
and
that's
not include multiplayer.
Is that the developer's fault, or is it a marketing issue? Because I feel like, you know.
Oh, it's a marketing issue. I don't blame the developers at all for this. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I feel like you don't play as a two player game because the dog has a completely different purpose in the game than being, you know, a second player. Like, it's there to help sort of fuel the alchemy system. And at the same time, mm-hmm. it also has some functionality in combat to help you out and back you up. But that's not the idea. Is not for you to be like equals. It's I don't know. It's just a different game, and that's
I
feel like I intuited that from the start, where some people didn't. That's not a dig at you, Jared. I'm just saying, like,
no.
I feel like a lot of the complaints about the game kind of miss the idea that the dog is not meant to be, you know, the sprite from Secret of Mana. It's meant to be like this thing that helps you develop your own character's magic skills. And, you know, sometimes he'll bite like an enemy dog or something.
A raptor.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you enough, Jeremy, but if I take myself back in time and I look at a game coming out in 1995 and 2 years before, a game called Secret of, I played 40 hours co-op with a friend, and it had ring menus and it had two companions. And then I get my single player experience. I'm probably going to feel stilted. That's my guess.
Right. Yeah. In fairness, I don't have any friends and I don't play video games with anyone. So
that's your friends.
Okay. That's exciting. I'm still not playing video games with you though.
Okay. That's fair. I'm not playing video games with anyone except myself these days. And I like it that way. Thank you very much. But I will say that the dog, to his credit, has far better AI than... See, I play Secret of Mana single player, God help me. And it's that AI was garbage. Just that was just to remind people, you could not go ahead if your friends got stuck behind something. And they got stuck behind something all the time. I had a huge, huge nightmare in the Sunken Continent where there's a whole area full of spikes or something that you have to cut down so you can get through. And your enemies will sit there. Sorry, your friends will sit there and get their asses kicked since they can't move beyond the stuff, and you can't move on beyond without them. But thankfully, the dog isn't like that. The dog is definitely a lot more free and loose, and it does get stuff done. Like Jeremy said, it sniffs out ingredients. It attacks things on occasion. It's a good doggo. Although I see it from Jared's point of view as well. Whereas it would be a really fantastic experience for a second player if you could play it equivalent as a player.
Well, and I think one other way in which the dog differs as well is not only better AI, but if I recall correctly, your dog is consistently way stronger than you are throughout most of the game.
Yeah.
And the dog essentially carries you to the finish line a lot of the time. Not completely. Obviously, you have your alchemy, but stat-wise, at least in my game, if I recall correctly, the dog was way stronger than I ever was. Maybe
yeah.
until the very end game.
I mean, poodles, they'll mess you up.
Poodles will mess you up, man. Poodles know what they want.
They're
don't screw with
dogs.
Them. They are hunting. They're retriever dogs. That's why they're shaped the way they are, to keep their joints warm. And that is dog facts today.
It does have a kind of a shades of like haunting ground to it that I like. The dog is really tough and he is really useful and he's your friend, you know, and that's a neat thing. You're not quite as helpless as you are on haunting ground, but it's still really a neat idea.
Yeah, I kind of scorned a little bit the whole, you know, boy and his dog theme, but I personally now, from my point of view, it's still a classic that you can't go wrong with. Like, I don't know if any of you have read Where the Red Fern Grows. Like, that is a story that is guaranteed to destroy you, and it is like the quintessential. God, now that I think about it, all these boy and his dog things are meant to destroy you. I think the only one that won't is a boy and his dog, ironically. So it works out as a theme. It's hard to go wrong with here's a boy, here's his dog. I always like games that let you adventure alongside an animal companion. You really can't go wrong in that regard. I think maybe, and we'll get into this right now, I suppose, is the real problem was that for me, and this is something I realized playing the game recently, Secret of Evermore is quite unbalanced and not very fun for that reason. It's very easy to get your ass kicked early in the game. I can't remember if you can upgrade your weapons the way you can in Secret of Mana, but either way, you are outclassed for a lot of it. And I don't know if any of you remember that at all.
Oh, 100%. I remember that game feeling incredibly oppressive difficulty-wise. And part of that, I think, is due to the nature of the alchemy system, which I know we'll get into more. Great, super unique system for sure, but so badly balanced in the sense that, you know, in Secret of Mana, you could just, you know, magic points were a refillable resource, so you could just keep casting spells to level up each spell.
Right.
With alchemy, you have to have those materials, and some of those materials are really hard to come by in the early games, so you almost don't want to cast alchemy spells because you want to save them for when you need them, but then they remain weak because you're not casting them and leveling them up. And so I think that was one of the main issues with an otherwise really interesting, unique system.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's thinking about it, it's really kind of the charge versus magic points debate in a way all over again. And I don't think it suits Evermore very well, even though, as you said, it's very unique. I love the idea, but
yeah,
if you did need to cast spells to level them up, correct? So yeah, that's not going to work out very well, especially since Secret of Mana, and I think it was the same for Secret of Evermore as well. It was your spells that really hit against the bosses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about the alchemy system? Because it is very important.
Sure.
And it is pretty different, although, as Jared does point out, it was something that you saw in Ultima 4. But, you know, for a console-based RPG, crafting, forging, like, that's the thing now. That's a, you know, like a gameplay loop that just pads out the gameplay time. Every developer loves that. It's a great way to create an artificial sense of worth for your money. But the alchemy system in this game is really interesting because basically you have spells, and in order to cast those spells, you need to find the proper reagents for those spells and create the combinations and, you know, link them together. And if I'm not mistaken, you can either find spells like, you know, combinations in the world, but you can also sort of discover them yourself.
Yeah.
But the thing is, discovery is challenging because you only have a finite number of reagents. You always have to be on the lookout for additional alchemic, you know, resources. Your dog will help you sniff things out, and you never know what he's going to find.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it kind of feels like, you know, they were playing with the same idea that Square's Japan Studio would tackle a few years later with Final Fantasy VIII and the draw system. But
right.
You know, it's the combination of materials. And, you know, the more you use a spell, the more it more powerful becomes. There's a little bit of saga going on there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Secret of Mana did that too. But
yeah,
as you cast certain spells, they become more powerful. But the thing is, there are some spells, like really good spells, that you will never be able to level up because you will never find enough reagents to use them more than two or three times. There's a couple of items that I remember, you know, all this time later, I remember, like, I only found two or three of them. I'm like, well, okay, I want to cast this really kick-ass spell, but I wonder if I will ever find more of these reagents, and I never did. So I used those spells, like, once. That doesn't make them more powerful. That just, you know... Like,
I'm
sure that spell could have been godlike if I had raised it up a couple of tiers, but I never had the chance. So it just feels like there were some mechanics that were very underutilized, and they really needed to spend more time balancing and refining the alchemy system, because I think it's a really cool idea and adds a lot to the gameplay and adds some strategy to the gameplay. But, you know, some of the more punishing limitations, I think, undermined the overall experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, I'm a person who has trouble using spells in the first place. So I'm like, oh God, my MP, what shall I ever do? And no matter how many things there are to restore it. And so as you said, Parrish, where you have a game where it gives you like maybe one or two ingredients for casting a spell, you really don't want to cast any spells. It's not very fun. It kind of keeps you in a very tense state of mind. So I still love the idea. And again, God, right now, what's the biggest game on the charts? Elden Ring, which is all I craft the hell in that game. I like Final Fantasy 14. The crafting classes are absolutely nuts. Crafting is everything. And this is one of the first RPGs that I can think of that really kind of primitive as it was, it really introduced the idea to us. And I think it certainly deserves credit for that. Unless there was another RPG for the SNES that I'm overlooking in terms of crafting.
Nothing comes to
top of my head. I can't think of anything. Yeah.
But the problem is, you know, I think the system would have worked if there were less permanence to the materials. If you had an easy way to kind of restock them and you had maybe like a max number of reagents or something, then, you know, like you could go into a dungeon and, whoa, you can only use that really powerful spell two times because that's as many of those reagents as you can ever hold. But then, mm-hmm. you know, you leave the dungeon and it's really easy to refresh them. And there are shops and stuff. There's like a bazaar, but they're not very consistent. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty scarce resources. And, so it's not something you can rely on. It's not like in, you know, like a Final Fantasy game where there's towns all over the map and you can fly to one pretty easily. It's much more difficult.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, a system with potential, but also the need for refinement.
Yeah.
I like what Nadia said earlier, just pointing out the comparisons to Elden Ring or FromSoft, that, you know, you do have crafting at Elden Ring, you're going to find some resources, but you also have those precious, precious items of which there are a finite number in that giant big world too. And you're just like, oh God, when do I use it? Oh God. Oh God. And you can see some of that horror in this as well.
Yeah. And
right.
Probably guarded by a giant that will step on you and kick you off the cliff as you, as you strike the last blow. I'm not going to say that happened to me with Godfrey the Grafted today, but I might have actually struck the final blow and fallen off a cliff at the same time. And do you think the game counted it as a win? No. No, it did not. No, absolutely not. But I think that, Jeremy, you did a great job kind of describing the game's issues in general. It had some fantastic ideas that maybe they needed more time in the oven to cook. I doubt that the team had the luxury of time on its side, given this was the end of the SNES's life. Who knows how busy Square was with other stuff. Maybe they couldn't give them the support that they needed. So you had a team that, for all intents and purposes, are very talented. And I want to point out a review that Next Generation did. And Next Generation magazine, if you recall, hated everybody, everything, especially RPGs. And
yeah,
but even Next Generation said, you know what, this is not a perfect game, but this is a really promising team, and we're looking forward to seeing what comes out of it next. And unfortunately, we never got that chance. I think the team is disbanded. Of course, everyone moved on to different places. Like, again, this was a talented team. They all had potential. So we will never get a team like that ever again. And that's really a darn shame, I think. It's really a product of his time.
Yeah, they're stuffed in a closet someplace with Aki Ross. That was my guess, but that's where the team was. But
yeah, a lot of the team went on to establish Big Rain, the
right
company that gave us – wow, I just totally blinked on – oh, Shadow Madness. That's it. So,
oh wow, okay,
yeah, that was a troubled game too.
Was it supposed to be like any sort of a follow up to Evermore? Or was it really?
No, it was straight up them saying like, oh, Final Fantasy VII, we should do a game like that. And,
oh dear. Oh no.
it just had a lot of problems. It wasn't that great. It was still better than Legend of Dragoon though.
Oh, them's fighting worse, as Kat and I have discovered on our own on the Absolute Blood God podcast. People will get very mad at you if you say that.
Nice.
But I'm not here to dump on anyone's, you know, love for games. Again, Secret of Evermore has its strengths. I think that, there are certain things that they could have foregone from the start. Like, this is controversial, but I feel like the Secret of Mana ring menu and maybe even the charge system as well, which Evermore had both of those, I felt like they confused newcomers more than anything than like really add much to the game. But maybe I'm alone in this thought.
No, I think you're probably right about that. Straight up, I'll be completely truthful. I never really liked the ring system in Secret of Mana. I've never liked the ring system in any game it's popped up in. And I don't think it's great in Evermore either. I think it's a neat idea, but I think it ends up being more confusing and obtuse than anything.
Yeah, I had a friend who I loaned Secret of Mana to because she was a huge Zelda Link to the Past fan, and she had no idea what was going on. And when I thought back in retrospect, I realized, yeah, you know what? I understand why, especially I didn't give her any sort of instruction booklets, and back then you didn't really have tutorials you could consult. So, yeah, I feel like maybe Evermore should have foregone that ring system. Again, it was another thing that tied us into Secret of Mana, thinking it was a sequel to that. It didn't really help the game's case, but if you want to sound in on that, Parrish and or Jared, be my guest.
I feel like the ring system only worked in Secret of Mana. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only time it worked.
And even then, it was kind of confusing.
Not ruled.
Yeah, I liked it in Secret of Mana as well. It looked neat on the screen, that high-res drawing there. It just stood out and popped in a neat way. We didn't need it again. And as for the attack charging, without the mobility, it loses a lot of its mechanical utility. Like, it's there to keep you from spamming attacks and knocking people across the screen Zelda style, but if you don't have the foot speed and the movement ability to make use of it, if you don't have the punch to take somebody down in a proper number of blows without having to sit there and wail away and they get torn apart, it doesn't work. And unfortunately, Evermore's enemies are just too spongy. You don't hit hard enough. You don't move fast enough. And suddenly the chart, you'd have done better with just knocking things back Zelda style. I think it would have been more engaging.
No, I think I agree with that for sure. Because Secret of Mana, for all its flaws, I feel like the rhythm of hitting enemies, once you get it, it's very weighty. Mm-hmm. It has a really good feeling to it. I still feel like Secret of Mana feels like a good game to play. And that's one of the reasons why. Like, you see your first Rabbite thing. I think it's an adorable name. And you hit it, and it dies in two hits. And then you level up, and you can kill it in one hit. It's a very good progression that wasn't there for Secret of Evermore. Secret of Evermore, from the very start, put you against raptors that could take, as you said, Jared, like 5 hits. And they could stun lock the hell out of you. And they did. And that was very frustrating.
Absolutely. I have to say, Nadia, there is one thing I'm surprised you haven't brought up about this game. One very cool thing, given that not too long ago, we ranked all the Final Fantasy IV characters together.
And that is the fact
that there is a really neat and so random cameo from Cecil and Rosa from FF4 here in this game. And it was really kind of a sweet cameo too, because they're older here. They're like, they're so in your head, you can kind of have the headcanon like, oh, you know, yeah, you see them get married at the end of FF4, but you get to see them grow older together and they're still super crazy about each other. And it just gives you kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling, you know? It was cute.
So now I have a timely
question.
And
then the after years came out.
Does this happen? Yeah, I was going to ask, is this before or after the after years in terms of
I thought about that, but then I was like, but then we have to bring in the after years into it, and nobody wants to bring the after years into anything. So
I would. I totally would. I double dog dare myself.
Fair enough.
I would say it's before because they don't have here's the thing. Here's what I understand. They went to whatever world Evermore is and opened up a weapon shop. In fact, Cecil gives you the bazooka, which is a weapon you can get.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. And he asks you, hey, you heard of me? I'm had a really famous adventure. And apparently you tell him, no, I haven't done that, but it sounds hilarious. Mm-hmm. But he and Rosa are married. They don't have their kid yet. So maybe my headcanon, they got married. They went to this place. They tried to open up a weapon store. It didn't work out. So they went back to Baron or wherever and decided, okay, we're king and queen again.
Yeah.
And then popped out a kid and that was that.
Yeah.
It works for me. They're the end. Great stuff.
Thank you for reminding me, Nadia, of another thing about this game that irritates me, which is that it instantly gives you a really good weapon, the bazooka in the beginning, and then takes it away from you and hands you a bone.
Oh, yes.
And there's
it's
that.
It's such
too.
A Super Metroid moment or a Metroid Prime moment.
Yeah, that's only allowed in Metroid Prime and Castlevania. Like any other time.
I agree. No, because Castlevania and Metroid do that so well. Whereas, because you lose that stuff in those games. And Castlevania, you build yourself up back very quickly. Like, okay, well, you lost your everything, but here's a sword. And you gradually just kind of take things from Dead Skeleton, which I know is kind of a redundant thing to say, but you build yourself up. And by the time you're done with the lobby area, you have enough to go on and you feel confident about taking on the alchemy lab. It's not the case here where they take away your bazooka and you start getting your ass kicked 6 ways from Sunday. So you don't get that really sense of satisfactory progression. And that's worth a lot, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
So one of my last points here as to why the game just kind of got overlooked, very, very simple, end of the SNES's life cycle. It happened to a lot of great games, you know, RIP, Earthbound, Yoshi's Island, there's a big one that I missed. So it just, and the SNES had some really incredible games in its final years. So you were probably buying, again, Yoshi's Island and not Secret of Evermore, which, again, as we've said many times already, was a good game, but next to what had come out already in the latter half of the SNES's life, maybe not so impressive. And I don't want to say exactly like just kind of landed with a wet fart, but because that's such a vulgar thing to say.
Gosh.
I almost feel like it's half accurate.
That was the secret of the soundtrack, all those sampled wet farts.
You know, and it probably...
Only the Super NES sound chip could do it.
It probably also didn't help either that it wasn't just kind of... It didn't really stand out against its contemporaries that released before and around it, but it also kind of paled in comparison to some of the super late era SNES games released after it, like Super Mario RPG.
Yeah,
right.
And it just kind of falls through the cracks when you consider all those games it's often compared to that released around the same time or even after it, and even before it in Chrono Trigger's case in FF6. It's just flanked on all sides by games that are just more notable and far more, you know, impressive at their time, and even now, in hindsight, than Secret of Evermore was, even though Evermore is a good game that's worth playing.
Yeah. It's interesting, now that you mention that, Ash, I'm thinking about how the Super Mario RPG was so many people's first RPG that they went to, and whereas Evermore got completely overlooked, even though Mario RPG came out, like, God, it was almost a year later, 1996. And I wonder why that was, if that was just because... number one, it was a more turn-based RPG with some action mixed in. Or number two, just Mario. And
it's
that's
Mario.
All I really have to say.
That's what I
know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can say for sure that one of my own best friends, he, on principle, he doesn't like JRPGs. He even hates Chrono Trigger. He has terrible tastes.
Oh,
he
my
just does.
Gracious.
And the only Final Fantasy he likes is 12 because it's essentially Star Wars and he has the most Western influence in the series. He's super into era against JRPGs in general. But he cites Mario RPG as one of his favorite games of all time because Mario invited him into that genre in a friendly, you know, shallow, let dip your toe into the shallow end of the pool kind of way. And I think that's what really got a lot of people into it who otherwise wouldn't have tried Final Fantasy or the Secret of Mana or Chrono Trigger or Dragon Quest or anything like that.
Absolutely. No. And I have to say, Super Mario RPG to this day, even though it's not my favorite RPG, it's really well done. Very tightly done.
It's great.
We're not talking about, again, like Evermore, which just kicks the crap out of you as soon as it can. It's, as you said, it lets you dip your toe in there. It's a very, very beginner-friendly game. And, of course, it has charm out the wazoo. Like, it is bright. It is colorful. Mario does not talk, but he pantomimes everything, and it's still fantastic to watch. It's hilarious. So, yeah, that's just interesting that it worked out that way. But that is certainly the way it worked out. And, gosh, unless you guys have some differentiating closing thoughts here, I was going to ask you, although I guess we've given our answers by this point, do you think that Secret of Evermore deserves to be kind of talked about more, or does it kind of deserve to, you know, exist in its corner, this dusty corner of 16-bit RPG history?
It deserves to be talked about less, but with less prejudice. Like, this is a game we probably wouldn't talk about if it didn't have Secret of stuck on it. Again, it'd just be – Jeremy made a really great point earlier on. The fact is, this is a better game than very many of the RPGs and action RPGs that came to the platform. It is a quality video game. And for all our complaints about this and that and the other of it, you know, you were talking about the difficulty a second ago. And yet, yes, it's really hard. Was that them going, looking at Mystic Quest to go and we'll show you, you know, here, complain about Mystic Quest. Uh-huh. We'll show you. Fine. Well, this is going to be a hard game. You're going to, I don't know, but I do think that it deserves more love for its good parts and it deserves far less notoriety for its flaws.
That's a good way to put it.
That is definitely a good way to put it, for sure.
And I also think the answer to that, at least to some degree, depends on who you are. I mean, I wouldn't go out of my way to recommend Secret of Evermore just to anybody.
No,
right? I don't think it's something that everybody needs to go out of their way to play, not even close. But if you are a scholar of games or you are super into games from the 16-bit era and you want to have the full context of all the games that came out in that era and want to be able to talk about it, you know, if you love the kind of thing that Secret of Evermore is or tries to be and you care about the history of games, absolutely you should play it. It's definitely worth playing. It's pretty good.
Right.
It's just not necessarily required playing, I think, outside of that bubble or maybe a slightly wider bubble than that.
And Mr. Parrish, what do you think?
Let's see. No, I feel like it's okay not to focus a lot on Secret of Evermore because it is ultimately kind of like a little video game Galapagos. Like it's an evolutionary dead end. Uh-huh. It didn't really influence anything else. It definitely showed some influences, but at the same time, it tried to be different. I don't know, like it's just this little thing that happened in video games, kind of a one-off, despite its kind of legacy connections. And I'm okay with that. It doesn't need to be revered necessarily, but it's still pretty darn good.
I like the description you used there, video game Galapagos, in that.
That's great.
You know, maybe don't like walk all over it and put your hands all over it because it'll, you know, just don't do that. But it is certainly worth observing and studying. And we were talking about, say, for example, the crafting. And I can't exactly say, oh, the games looked at this and started crafting. It didn't happen that way. And you guys mentioned something about Ultima 4 having the same crafting system. So I guess maybe it kind of took it from there. But yeah, it just existed, didn't it? It was its own little dimensional pocket, which is very appropriate considering the theme of the game, which is kind of like, you know, dimensional hopping. So bravo. Bravo, Secret of Evermore. Gave us a really fun, lively discussion, I think. It's not an extremely long episode, but I think we packed it full of a lot of interesting thoughts about this really, really odd game.
Yeah, this was a patron request episode, but I cannot find the name of the patron who requested it, and I apologize for that. I did find an auction I won on eBay for a copy of this game, UN Squadron, and Run Saber, and the three games nice. Combined cost me $75.
Wow.
Just to give you a hint of
what year was
that? Was 2013. That was a long time ago.
That was certainly a long time ago in the context of the youth video game market, for sure.
Yeah.
That's really impressive. So good on you. And actually, I want to correct myself. Earlier, I said I had a repro cart. No, apparently my husband, like, he sent me a message saying, no, he bought me the Genuine article. So thank you, husband, for doing that. That was very nice. Good of you. I got confused maybe because he also got me a repro cart of Terranigma. at the same time. So,
okay.
Yeah. Which is another fantastic RPG. It is a fantastic action RPG, and we've talked about it on Blood God and the Pantheon of the Blood God.
Yeah.
Go ahead and check that out. Now, go ahead.
Sorry, one second. We've name dropped Soul Blazer once. We've name dropped Terranigma once. I have to name drop Illusion of Gaia because it's one of my favorite games of all time. I just had to make sure we said it.
I was actually going to say this game, there are parts of it that remind me of some of the settings and environments, a lot of Illusion of Gaia. And then the conversation moved on and I forgot to say it. But yes, I agree.
No, you're right. Yeah. Like the historic sort of like, of course, Illusion of Gaia, you were going to actual landmarks like Angkor Wat and stuff.
Yeah.
And you go to different like periods of time that would have like those kinds of ruins and whatnot. So I can definitely see the why you would make that connection. Mm-hmm. And I agree, Ash, that Illusion of Gaia is a fantastic game. I could talk about it for 24 hours solid.
Me too.
And I will do it.
Yes,
if you dare me. So
same. I could talk about that game forever. Maybe we should sometime.
We absolutely should.
That is a future episode.
That is a threat. And I very much mean to act on it sometime in the future.
Looking forward to it.
But for now, that's it for this dog morphing episode of Retronauts. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks to Parrish, Jared, and Ash for joining me. If you think this episode is cool, we have tons more content like it. Just visit the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts for access to media that is both fun and educational. If you support us at the $3 level, you will receive early access to weekly episodes. Support at the $5 level gets you episodes a week early and 2 exclusive episodes a month. Now support us at the magic number 64 for the opportunity to set the topic of a Retronauts episode once every 6 months. But as of this recording, there's one spot left. So it might not be there anymore by the time this goes up, or it might be there. If it's there, snap it up while you can. So, Jeremy, as usual, I've kind of promoted a lot of your stuff here, but go ahead and just kind of patch in where I missed.
Sure. I will say I have to correct myself. This was not a patron request episode. I thought it was, but I just looked through the records, and actually I've had it on the list of topics we should cover for several years. So
there we are.
That would explain why I can't find the request for this topic, because it was my request. Thank you for fulfilling my request, Nadia. I feel like that was money well spent.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope you were happy with it.
I was. This was really enjoyable. Thank you for
it was fun
putting the episode together. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, on Retronauts as Jeremy Parrish. That's this podcast. Yeah. On YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, and at Limited Run Games as Jeremy Parrish.
That's a lot of Jeremy Parrishes. Mm-hmm. How about you, Jared?
Good branding.
Well, I share an office with four named Jeremy Parrish, and I get to see all the Jeremy Parrish I could stomach and then some. but you can find me on Twitter at PettyCommaJared. I make a little show called the Top 100 Games Podcast. It's fun. We have a different guest every week or month or whenever we record the thing. That guest comes on, picks one of their favorite games of all time, and we riff on it. That's about all there is to it. It's fun. It's sweet. I like it. You can listen to it if you like to. And, of course, go to Limited Run Games and see the neat things we're making. We're getting ready to open a physical retail store. I'm pretty excited about
that. That's sweet. So cool.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So. Good luck with that. That's really awesome.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it. So.
And how about you, Ash?
So, once again, I'm Ash Paulson. You can find me on Twitter at my name, A-S-H-P-A-U-L-S-E-N. I mainly tweet about video games, video game music, dogs, and food. So if you like that stuff, definitely follow me on Twitter. And again, I'm the creator and co-founder of Good Vibes Gaming. You can find us on YouTube at youtube.com/GVGOfficial and on Patreon at patreon.com/GVGaming. And it is basically me and Derek, Steve, and John from the old Game Exclaim crew, reunited under a new umbrella, doing our own thing. So if you like what we did at GX, definitely follow us over at GVG. And Nadia, thank you so much again for inviting me. This has been a blast.
Oh, anytime. Glad to have you on. You're always great to have on. And I owe you so much. I owe like a million guest spots on on Good Vibes Gaming. That's for sure.
No, fair enough. Yeah.
I am at Nadia Oxford on Twitter. That is all one word. And as I said, I am part of the Axe of the Block God RPG podcast. We talk about RPGs, old and new, Eastern and Western. You can support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. We have lots of tiers for you to kind of hang out with us and watch us record our episodes live. And usually a cat knocks something over and it's hilarious. So how can you say no to that? Also, I also do the Charlene Dropouts podcast, which is a Final Fantasy XIV podcast that goes up every month, again, under the Blood God umbrella. Plus, I have written things. My husband and I wrote the Mega Man X. What the hell is it called?
The Mega Man X Maverick Hunter's Field Guide, which I edited.
Field Guide. That's right.
You guys did such a great job writing.
You did.
And I got to edit it. It was so fun.
That was a fun thing to write. And we also wrote the Robot Masters Field Guide.
Right.
And hopefully more in the future. Who knows? It was great. So, yeah, thanks for editing at that, Ash. That was a good job.
Dude, it was completely my pleasure. You and your husband absolutely killed it. It was a lot of fun.
Ah.
Plus, we're all just such big Mega Man nerds. It was fun to come together on that project.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, it showed. So, thanks again for listening. Now, go make some chemical explosions with fire eyes.
Secret of Evermore, I am the danger.